Joe, how you doing?
Just fine, Tim. I'm here tonight, you know, wondering about all of the different secret societies we have to deal with. And of course, perhaps the best known and the one that has us most under observation right now as we speak is known as the CIA.
Yes, CIA. I got my cloak and dagger here, so I'm all ready to discuss CIA. It's not the CIA, it's CIA. As what was said was the end of the movie The Good Shepherd. They said, well, how come they call it CIA? No, don't say the CIA. He says, well, you don't say the God, you say God. So, CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. Well, okay, let's see, go through all things Wikipedia again to explain the history of the CIA according to the official narrative. CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, is a civilian foreign intelligence service of the United States federal government. What do we do here? True. Can you hear me okay?
Just fine.
Okay. Page is a little different there. Okay, so, okay, start again. Okay, the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, is a civilian foreign intelligence service of the United States federal government, tasked with gathering, processing, and analyzing national security information from around the world, primarily through the use of human intelligence, or HUMINT. As one of the principal members of the U.S. intelligence community, the CIA reports to the Director of National Intelligence and is primarily focused on providing intelligence for the President and his cabinet. Unlike the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is the domestic security service, the CIA has no law enforcement function and is mainly focused on overseas intelligence gathering with only limited domestic intelligence collection. Though it is not the only U.S. Government agency specializing in human intelligence, the CIA serves as the national manager for coordination of HUMINT activities across the U.S. intelligence community. Moreover, the CIA is the only agency authorized by law to carry out overseas covert action at the behest of the president. It exerts foreign foreign political influence through its tactical divisions, such as the Special Activities Division. Before the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004, the CIA director concurrently served as the head of the intelligence community. Today, the CIA is organized under the Director of National Intelligence, DNI. Despite transferring some of its powers to the DNI, the CIA has grown in size as a result of the September 11th attacks. Of course, when the CIA was created, its purpose was to create a clearinghouse for foreign policy intelligence and analysis. Today, its primary purpose is to collect, analyze, and evaluate, disseminate foreign intelligence, and to perform covert actions. The Central Intelligence Agency was created on July 26, 1947, when President Harry S. Truman signed the National Security Act into law. The major impetus for the creation of the CIA was the unforeseen attack on Pearl Harbor. In addition, towards the end of World War II, the U.S. government felt the need for a group to coordinate intelligence efforts. Its immediate predecessor was the Office of Strategic Services. Franklin Delano Roosevelt authorized the creation of this intelligence service, modeled after the British Secret Intelligence Service (MI6) and Special Operations Executive. This led on September 20, 1945, shortly after the end of World War II. Harry S. Truman signed the executive order dissolving the OSS. By October 1945, its functions had been divided between the Department of State and War. The division lasted only a few months. The first public mention of Central Intelligence Agency appeared on a command restructuring proposal presented to Jim Forrestal and Arthur Radford to the U.S. Senate Military Affairs Committee at the end of 1945. Despite opposition from the military establishment, the United States Department of State, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Truman established the National Intelligence Authority in January 1946. Its operational extension was known as the Central Intelligence Group, which was a direct predecessor of the CIA. Of course, the justification for such an agency, especially in peacetime, a clandestine service agency, that nation needs to collect intelligence from its potential enemies abroad. Of course, the idea that the CIA is an intelligence gathering operation is in itself sort of a propaganda. It's a cover. The Central Intelligence Agency's primary purpose isn't so much intelligence gathering It's more or less, it's primarily operations, covert operations involving economic warfare, psychological warfare, rigging elections, at home and probably, abroad and probably at home, assassinations and fomenting civil wars and creating genocide and things like that. They say also, instead of really collecting intelligence for the president, actually distorts intelligence for the benefit of its masters, which is the corporations, Fortune 500, and the elite. Obviously the history of the CIA and its activity is it's a murderous history is well known, but broadly accepted as necessary in an imperfect and dangerous world. That's how most people view it, I suppose. So Joe, that's kind of like a summation of this, of the CIA, a little bit of my editorial thrown in there at the end. So what do you have to say about that?
Well, the CIA is a secret society. Who the hell knows what's inside the damn thing? You don't need secrecy if you know there's not real malevolence lurking somewhere inside the thing. And I know that so people will say, well, you know, it's a dangerous world, like you pointed out. They need secrecy to be able to snoop on other countries to get the malevolence that they're organizing against us. So this is what we've been told. This is why the CIA, which basically is part of the technologic structure of slavery that's like rapidly onsetting in the United States, is put up with, right? They give you this little storyline. But I actually want to look at the CIA in two ways. There's two different kind of structure concepts that I think people will it'll be useful for people to look at it in this way. The first of all is that the CIA is modeled after Freemasonry. And by that I mean you have concentric rings of sort of need to know that take you deeper and deeper into the core, and that's what's hidden from the public. So people will see on the outside, they'll know people involved in the CIA, perhaps, or people who've had contracts with the CIA of doing things, and people will look at that and they'll go, well, you see, the CIA is somehow integrated into American culture. It's part of democracy. But this would be the same mistake as to look at Freemasonry and to look on the outside and to see people that you know and think that that's really what's inside it. The design of the thing is to have people look at activities which seem beneficial. And so they would know, people on that perhaps are involved in it at these lower levels, but this is not really what the thing is designed to do. And the first way to recognize the CIA's real purpose would be probably to study MK Ultra. If you want to look at that operation, you can see that MK Ultra had nothing to do really with foreign nations. MK Ultra had at least 10% and maybe as much as 25% of the CIA's budget for year after year when it was first onset. So this was a huge project, and yet it really wasn't ever given to the public, and it had nothing to do with, snooping on overseas governments trying to see if they were going to attack the United States. It was simply designed to develop technology to enslave Americans. That's what MKUltra was. That was what the technology was developed to do. So that's the first marker as to, well, what's really inside the CIA is the fact that it would, perform human experiments on American citizens. So you can see right off the bat that the thing is, the story it gives to the American people is just ludicrous. It has nothing to do with really what's inside it. That's the very lowest level. That's just what is designed to be a deflection for people looking into it. And then the other, and I think a lot of people recognize that now. I think a lot of the alt media has done a really good job of exposing this. This is not something that is, you know, is it's not hidden inside the alt media. But the other thing's less well known, I think, and it isn't talked about as much, which is that the CIA's cover, the explanation that it gives for its existence to the public, that it's involved in this skullduggery, this battle of wits, you know, with the Soviet Union or with Islamic terrorist boogeyman or whoever, you know, they claim that they're in this snooping battle with, that's completely fake. That this dialectic, particularly the one about the Soviet Union, was fake. I mean, if you look at the Bolsheviks and look at the extent that Freemasonry was involved in fomenting the Bolshevik revolution, you can see that was just you know, part of the New World Order. It wasn't something that was separate. It was just the Russian operation. This led to coordination between the Masonic-controlled governments during World War II. In other words, if you go back through our shows, you can see we've discussed over and over again how World War II was artificial. It was just a cover narrative, the World War, for genocide of the European. And so this was, you know, certainly part of what was going on in Russia. And therefore, you can see that, like at the Yalta Conference, where you have the known Masons, Churchill and Roosevelt, right? They're just outed. But they're in, you know, having this discussion with Stalin. Stalin is not as well known, but I would just invite everyone to go and look at all the photographs and paintings of Joseph Stalin with the hidden hand. And I would say that obviously links into the Masonic control over the Bolshevik Revolution, which is harder to trace. I mean, they just don't have that many primary documents to go from, but the first head of the Soviet, I can't even pronounce the name, starts with CH. I mean, he was known as a Mason. The Masons are all through the thing. You're getting funding from basically this combination of Masonic and Jewish banking families that we've seen over and over again in, you know, in the West. So I would say pretty obviously that the Soviet Union was just, you know, that branch of the New World Order, and that the struggle with it is artificial, right? That would be my position, is that the dialectic, you know, the struggle between two forces is the thing that most confuses us in general about everything in reality, but certainly about like world political structure. I think that the Gorbachev Perestroika thing was also fake. I mean, you know, Gorbachev's connection into, you know, secret society is pretty clear cut. The fact that he was working with Soros, I think, is particularly revealing. And so, you know, I think that that's the other way to look at the CIA, is that it's, as you look into it, it's Freemasonry and it's structured. It has need to know concentric rings inside the thing, and the public looks in and we only see what we're meant to see. The inside of the thing is malevolent. It's involved with things like 911, you know, and God knows what else, but it certainly is just absolutely evil and malevolent, but it defends itself from public awareness by all these levels and different ways of kind of, you know, being complex, and that the overall dialectic that it was created to, you know, because it needed to be created because, my gosh, there's this terrible force, you know, the Soviets, that's fake too. That was just the first cover story that just gave us the excuse to set up the CIA, and that really now what I think it's mostly involved with is just, you know, onsetting a kind of technologic slave state, where basically human consciousness can be manufactured. That's really what the real purpose of the CIA is at this point. I have a lot, you know, other things I'm worried about, but Tim, what do you think about the CIA? What is it?
Well, I mean, it's a clandestine agency, of course, and it shrouds itself in secrecy. And ironically, and you go into the building itself, they have the slogan, you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free.
John 3:22.
Of course, now you say that, you know, there's no accountability and all these things, but, you know, the director of Central Intelligence is confirmed by the U.S. Senate, and there's congressional oversight, right? There's the Senate Intelligence Committee, and then we've had, in the 70s, you had the Church Committee hearing, the Pike Committee hearings, you had the Rockefeller Commission, and you had, you know, William Colby sharing the family secrets, the family jewels with the public, and, you know, obviously I'm being sarcastic. You know, we have the New York Times and Washington Post reporting on scandals of the CIA, so we know we have democracy, we have free. Point well taken. It's an agency itself, again, as I read in the introduction, it said one of the reasons for its creation was the U.S. government needed to coordinate the intelligence of the various agencies like Office of Naval Intelligence, Army Intelligence, and these things, State Department, because of the failure to connect the dots that led to the raid on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. We now know that's a lie. The Franklin Delano Roosevelt was fully, and his advisors were fully aware of the impending attack. In fact, they encouraged it, and they monitored it the whole way, because that was the backdoor to war, his backdoor to war into the Second World War. That's mostly acknowledged now, so it's not even controversial. The only people who think it's controversial are the ignorant or the blind. So that its cover story is a lie. Now, you can look at the agency itself as sort of a the creation of it, its official creation, 1947, under the National Security Act, as sort of a consummation or of a sort of untoward relationship between big business and government and these things. These relationships, shared interests, have been going back, at least in the United States, you know, for the better part of a century, with the rise of oligarchy after the so-called American Civil War. Big industrials, families like the Rockefellers, the Harrimans, and these things, these groups that had, you know, fomented the Spanish-American War for their so-called sugar interests and national city banks. So this is high finance, interest of high financing, banking, and industry, more or less taking over the U.S. government to pursue its rather narrow interest in the name of the American people. So what you had in 1947, again, was sort of this it became formalized, this union. And this is told so much, and if you look at what the agency itself is, the agency, you know, it always had rather the national security agenda, it's more of a corporatist agenda. The CIA's origins were elitist. It's well documented. They all came from Wall Street. And its sort of history of carrying out assassinations and coups and fomenting civil wars, always done for the benefit of corporations that are often represented by the director of Central Intelligence, like Alan Dulles. You know, when the CIA was formed, Alan Dulles himself formed a committee of all a bunch of Wall Street bankers and lawyers and these things. So these are the people who formed the committee, like half a dozen men, all came from Wall Street, that wrote up the more or less the plan for the Central Intelligence Agency. Alan Dulles himself was a great study. He was, I think, the third director of Central Intelligence, 1953 to 1961. And he was typical of this group of people. He was the OSS operative serving in Switzerland during the Second World War. He was heavily involved in the Operation Paperclip, negotiating with the SS for the surrender. I think the general was Wolf, General Wolf, SS general. He also was a senior partner of Sullivan and Cromwell, which is a well-connected Wall Street law firm, representing large American corporations that the CIA often went to bat for overseas. And if you look at some of its operations early on, fomented coup or revolution overthrew Mossadegh in Iran. That was done for the benefit of the Seven Sisters, the oil companies. And you had the 1954, you had the overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala. That was done for the benefit of the United Fruit Company. And even after Dulles left in 1973, had the same situation going on in Chile when they overthrew what was his name?
Allende,
and installed Pinochet. And this is all done because, you know, Allende was nationalizing these companies and running afoul of these powerful corporations in the United States. And I think at the time, the director of Central Intelligence was Richard Helms. And he was a board member of AT&T. And they call the CIA the company, right? That's what they call it. And even when you're working on a country, they say, I think it was, what's his name, A.G. in his book, in 1975 book, let's say, said, you know, talked about how they refer to the account. You have the South American account or the Russian account and these things. So it's an agency operating for the benefit of big business and the corporations and this elite, financial group. That's pretty much. I don't even think that's even controversial. That's just obvious. And you know, they thinly wrap it in the American flag and call it national security to avoid accountability. But you're right as far as if you look back at the origins of the CIA and things like you mentioned MK Ultra being applied domestically, which is completely illegal against its charter. But the agency itself really isn't guided by any law, although they claim to have restrictions and these things, guidelines, and they have a legal counsel and these things. But really, it's a lawless group, and it's a huge bureaucracy. So when we talk about CIA and CIA proper, people often, like you alluded to, people confuse, they may have someone who worked for the CIA being their neighbor, and he mows his lawn, he's nice, and you know he's not involved in any nefarious activities directly, perhaps, but most people aren't, say, because it's a huge bureaucracy. It's highly compartmentalized, and the way the agency operates is that you're dealing in concentric circles because the same entities that created the agency are the entities that control high finance, entertainment, advertising, movies. So the CIA is very much involved in coordinating culture creation, manipulation, and propaganda, psychological warfare. So the American people's understanding or perspective is skewed. So they never really know what's really going on. They can be buffaloed by claims like the CIA is out there protecting you from evil terrorists.
Yep. Yeah. The CIA was, you know, people have often pointed out that this was a product of the banks of high finance, and this is certainly true. But I mean, it begs the question as to how the banks would be able to organize something like this, and I think it shows that, as we have alluded in the past, that the banks themselves are basically a secret society. They're they're concentric circle inside of all of this malfeasance, and they are. I think that the reason why the banks were so involved with it is because the corporations that these banks controlled were going to be the bulwark of the so-called U.S. foreign policy. In other words, they were going to be the primary device for international enslavement. You know, AT&T and IBM and companies like this were going to come in and basically working with like the World Bank and make sure that the economies of the different nations were structured with a certain control system relating back to the companies that were tied with the CIA. And that's why if you look at the original directors, you know, you've got Donovan, and he's just an investment banker, Sidney Serrero, Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, Schlesinger, Colby Bush, of course. I mean, these guys can be described as a collection as just a, you know, investment banking firm. I mean, so there was something really wrong with the selection process of the CIA directors just from the perspective of democracy, because so many of them were basically coming from the financial world, and they weren't coming from, you know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington part of the financial world. They're coming from the very, you know, most oligarchic secret society oriented families imaginable. And I just wanted to point out that even before the CIA had been created, you can see the banking families controlling U.S. intelligence for these very purposes through the OSS. I mean, in that organization you had in Europe, particularly the Mellon family. Paul Mellon was one of the heads, and David Bruce, who was Andrew Mellon's son-in-law, was the director of European, you know, offices during World War II. And then you had the infamous Richard Mellon, I can't pronounce his last name, but Scaife, I believe it is.
Oh, the publisher, the guy who owned all the newspapers.
Yeah, and he was then the one who controlled all the newspapers and whatnot for the CIA.
He was kind of a right-winger, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was a right-winger, you know, with the Heritage Foundation and stuff. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, that's just, I mean, to me, this is just, you know, part of the cover narrative.
Yeah, and then the oligarchs also supported the New Republic, right?
Exactly. They can, yeah. You know, both sides of the stupid dialectic that the public is confused
National
by.
National Review, Wimoff Buckley, and he worked for E. Howard Hunt, yeah. So.
But you see, the way you can, like, look at this clearly, in my opinion, is that the house guest of the Dulles, of the Mellon family during the entire tenure as head of the CIA was Helms. Helms would be at visiting the Mellons every weekend during this whole period when he was CIA director. And then, okay, so just branch out for 1 second and bear in mind that then when you get into MK Ultra, you get into the production of the counterculture and the hippie, you've got the Millbrook Mansion where Tim Leary is living for some reason with Billy Hitchcock. I mean, who is Mellon's grandson, right? Mm-hmm. This is the same place that Dulles was a few months before. He was coming there. Now Tim shows up. And on the other side, you've got the ridiculous, you know, artificial construction and probably one of the most unpleasant musical organizations in history to listen to, the Grateful Dead, being funded by Peggy Mellon Hitchcock, right? So, you know, when you just sort of step back and just try to draw lines between the banking families and then how the CIA onsets, you can see that it was completely entwined with it. But as I said, it wasn't because the banking family, you know, was the secret society. They are just part of it. The reason why they were powerful and why they organized the overseas intelligence part of the United States is because they wanted to make sure with the secret society, the CIA, that they could basically control the economies of the developing world, and so that they would then have, you know, basically, develop an ant farm slave system, you know, with, you know, always, you know, with the skullduggery about, you know, we got to be in here. You need the CIA because those gosh darn commie agents will be, you know, fomenting revolution, and you're going to need us because you need free enterprise like a World Trade Organization or World Bank loan, which you'll never be able to pay back except by borrowing more money, which we'll gladly give you because we can just print an unlimited amount of it. And eventually we will own every single thing in this country and you will be completely indebted to us. And aren't you happy we showed up to help? You know, so this is the CIA. It's just this banking. The banks were very visible, and they produced all the directors in the beginning of it. But that's just because the secret society was going to use it as the international economic controlling system. I just wanted to throw in one little thing. The day after Truman signed the documents, he actually had a little ceremony. Did you know this?
Oh yeah, I read about this. Yeah.
His little pseudo Masonic ceremony. He actually brought out a bunch of like fake Mason stuff and created a little fake Masonic document and brought in his other people. They're all more Freemasons, and they had a little ceremony. You know, organizing. They were saying how great it is that now we can. We can create a new order. They actually use that expression in their little document. They didn't mention Freemasonry. They just had a little pseudo Freemason.
He was a 33rd degree Mason, wasn't he?
Well, supposedly. I mean, it's a secret society, but he wasn't shy about being a Mason. I mean, he was just like George Washington. He was always covered with that crap in his, whenever he was not in Washington. He was always, with his Masonic apron on and whatnot. But so,
and he, you know, he, of course, he came out of that dirty Pendergast machine, and you know,
yeah,
which, exactly. which solidifies, you know, again, you see the union of organized crime and central intelligence or in spycraft and politics right there with the someone like Harry Truman.
Absolutely, you know, and so then you know you have as far as the CIA's not wanting to enslave America, well, you can forget about that. I mean, certainly Operation Mockingbird can be, by any you know reasonable standards, seen as an effort to, like MK Ultra, like Operation Midnight Climax, like all these other things.
Yeah, I'm reading the Wikipedia thing. How can they make the claim that the CIA isn't primarily involved in domestic intelligence when things like MK Ultra and Operation Mockingbird have been exposed?
Yeah, well, I mean, here's you know, I have a question. Okay, so you got Operation Mockingbird, you've got Schlesinger talking about we've got every journalist control, we've got everything, you know, we own them all. They say, well, we put out 2,000 novels and, you know, this and that, we own everything. Well, wait a second. Has there ever been a statement of like, well, we've released all of these people from our employment? I mean, I've never seen this, you know? Yeah, I mean,
there's an anecdote that Doug Valentine, who's done great work on, you know, because his book, CIA is Organized Crime, his book about that. He that book does a great job explaining what the agency's really, its true mission really is. But he recounts the story. In 1990, he wrote a book on the Phoenix program, the first really book, and probably the only book I know of really that got the Phoenix program. And the way he did it was he was able to, he got access to William Colby, and Colby kind of liked him, and he'd written a book called Hotel Tacloban about his father as a prisoner in World War II in the Philippines. And he sent the book to Colby, and Colby liked the book and kind of, he consented to an interview and kind of gave him his blessing to talk to some of these people who were involved in Phoenix, because Colby ran Phoenix in Vietnam. So he wrote this book about exposing Phoenix, Operation Phoenix, or what it was. And it was, when it was published in 1990, it was suppressed and it was trashed in the New York Times by Morley Safer, CBS reporter Morley Safer, the muckraking reporter from 60 Minutes. And, you know, he always wondered why Morley Safer was chosen to do this, or he decided to write this book about Phoenix. And, well, 20 years later, a guy calls him up who's doing some research, and he finds out that Morley Safer, while he was in Vietnam, had been taken under the wing of Bill Colby and showed the sites. And this is how reporters, something like, he gets access to some information, so he's able to get the stories, but this he more or less is under the control of the agency from that point on, and then became a celebrity reporter, Morley Safer. And he only finds out that Morley Safer admitted this. He was giving a speech or something. It was at some breakfast or luncheon or something where he talked about being friends with Bill Colby. And lo and behold, in 1990, he writes this book, Trashing Phoenix, Doug Valentine's book on the Phoenix program. He's doing his job. It's almost like The Godfather, you know, I'll do your favor and I may ask you a favor someday. This day may never come, but it might. And when you do, I want you to, you know, to do this for me. And lo and behold, Morley Safer was there to trash the book, paying back the favor that Bill Colby had done for him back in the 1960s. Of course, Bill Colby was long dead by that point. So, so I thought that was an interesting illustration of how reporters and are controlled, you know, by the agency.
Yeah. Another good example, I think, you know, illustrative of all this is Gloria Steinem and feminism. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about that a number of times, that, you know, she was a CIA agent. She got outed. She had a bogus press conference where she lied again about what she was doing. The Red Stockings, legitimate feminist organization, they got the data. They just totally exposed her. And then what they exposed was also the concentric circles of evil that basically produce Ms. magazines, because then you have Katharine Graham, not just Katharine Graham, but you also had Warner Communication, mm-hmm. and AT&T, right? This is the funding source. But I've always thought, even like more amusing is that when you look back into Steinem's career as a spook, she was at these youth festivals in Europe, you know, breaking them up because they thought that socialism might actually be a vehicle for democracy at some point. So they had to stop that, nip that in the bud. And so they went around to these youth festivals, and she had this little gang of people. One of them, names escapes me, but he was the editor of New York Magazine that actually published the first edition of Steinem's book. So in other words, that he was part of the original circle in Europe, which was run by Cord Myers, incidentally. Mm-hmm. Right. Then of course ran Operation Mockingbird. So you can see the pieces are moving around, but it's the same chessboard. But what was fascinating to me was there was four people involved. You had Steinem, and then Cord Myers. Who was the editor of, I think it was New York Magazine. But the fourth individual who was there breaking up these youth festivals and fomenting violence was Barney Frank.
Really?
Now,
the congressman?
The bizarre and hideous gay congressman, Barney Frank.
He had a gay call boy operation running out of his basement?
Yeah, exactly. And so he was the other thug. Imagine Barney, you know, like beating up people, you know, it's hard to imagine. But he was actually with the cell that Cord Myers was operating. They were all CIA operatives, you know. I mean, they actually have Steinem's, you know, the document that she was creating, which was basically getting personal information for the purpose of control on individuals, which is exactly what at the press conference she claimed she never did. So you can see she was just a lying bitch right up, mm-hmm. you know, to the last, you know, she's just lying her head off, and she got called on this, but nothing ever happened, you know, because the mainstream media is controlled, and she was able to delay the publishing of the book and watered it down. There was just, you know, different things they could do. But the point I'm trying to make is that Frank is an example. I mean, because he becomes a congressman.
Yeah,
right?
Congressman is supposed to have oversight, right?
Right. And but moreover, it's like it's just like the, you know, you know, with Morley Safer, is that this background creates a kind of vetting. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
That so the agency sees this person as reliable, for one thing, because he was a bloody spook and probably did a bunch of illegal things, which mm-hmm. they would have over him. But moreover, because he's, you know, he would be inside the club, right? I mean, they wouldn't have to worry about him being off the reservation or having to control him. I mean, because he is, you know, Barney Frank is the secret society.
Yeah, and there's another example of that is back in 2005 when a congressman named Porter Goss became the director of Central Intelligence. You're thinking, why is a congressman being named director of Central Intelligence? Well, it turns out that Porter Goss has a long history in the intelligence agency, and here he is in Congress, a Florida congressman, but he traces back to Operation 40 and the whole Cuban thing back in the 60s with the Kennedy assassination. And linked in with Barry Seal. Barry Seal, a CIA smuggler who smuggled weapons and drugs for the agency, reportedly in Southeast Asia as a young man, and later in Central America in the 80s. So again, you have these people. You have congressmen who are CIA agents, you know, and also the same thing they do with the like Senate Intelligence Committee, supposed to exercise some oversight over the intelligence community. They'll put agents on the staff who to control the congressman should any congressman get, you know, uppity or troublesome. So it's very easily controlled. Of course, a lot of the things, the strategy with the CIA does is the old limited hangout, which we have with the Church Committee hearings and the Pike Committee hearings and the Rockefeller Commission hearings and these things, where they show a little leg, right? And,
yeah.
You know, the same thing they did with Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, you know, where it was more or less an attempt. If you really look at the Pentagon Papers, it was they blamed all the problems in Vietnam were blamed on the Defense Department. And the whole history of the CIA in Vietnam, which is probably the true history of the Vietnam War, because that traces back to control of the opium and heroin trade. the idea in the 50s when the CIA went in there, kind of nudged the French aside and took control of the situation. And we see that that's portrayed like the book, the Graham Greene's book, The Quiet American, where CIA agents are going in there and actually conducting false flag terrorism, bombs, and blaming it on North Vietnamese to justify further intervention into the conflict there. And of course, that also starts this whole thing with the whole war is a huge money-making operation, because that war, all the materiel is being used with the helicopters, the dredging of harbors, all the supplies going there enriched so many corporations, like KBR, Kellogg Brown and Root, who gave a lot of money to Lyndon Johnson, who of course was behind the escalation in 1960 after 1964, and Johnson himself made a huge amount of fortune through companies owned by his wife, who were making money off the Vietnam War. So,
yeah, I mean they manage all of the finances. I think these are kind of just payoffs for the puppets.
The money, yeah. This is
yeah. It's good. So they find a way, like the Clintons, you know, where they end up with $1 billion. So, you know, he can live on a yacht, and I don't know, she can get a sex change operation. I don't know what they do with the money, you know. But the thing is, they always tend to, you know, give them a whole bunch of money, but it's usually some kind of weak, absurd cover story, like when Tony Blair left, the prime ministership of Britain, the next week, J.P. Morgan hired him as some kind of international consultant for $10 million a year. I mean, it was just ludicrous, you know. But I think they have these cover stories just because they want to keep the idea that the currency has some kind of relationship to economic activity. I mean, frankly, they could just as easily print the money, you know, in the Federal Reserve and just blow up their checking account if they wanted to $1 billion.
Well, because, they do that.
Oh, sure, of course they do. But they have the cover story so that we think that the currency has some value.
You don't think the CIA has someone on the board of the New York Fed?
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, it would be, how shocking. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they the whole idea of currency having any real value is ludicrous. It's just the most active part of the mind control.
Mm-hmm.
Because since they control the printing press and the creation of credit, there isn't any standard or meaning to the thing. They just use it for control. And they have to keep the currency basically as a religion, you know, so as long as people believe it, then they can continue to just crank it out. And if people fail to believe it, they'll just create a new currency. You know, that's like that. Maybe that's what Bitcoin will become. The thing is ludicrous in my mind, and you wonder, well, why is it, you know, so popular? Well, it could just end up being another CIA, creating an alternative type of currency, so that if people start to realize the dollar is stupid, then they would go there. But it's just mind control, and so that's why, you know, when you just look at obvious control elements of culture. I mean, even one would be too many, but when you have so many things, I mean, when you look at feminism and the control over the media and the MK Ultra human experimentation, I mean, my God, the CIA is just basically a way of laughing at the concept of democracy. You see what I mean? I mean, it's just the fact that it exists at all, talking about how it's going to be snooping overseas, and then when you find out it's actually in any way at all inside our culture in the United States, you know that everything is fake. So it's a real problem for the democratic system here. We have to, in the same way we stop believing in money, we need to stop in the dollar, we need to stop believing in the CIA as anything other than just technologic malevolence, banking, secrecy organization that enables the secret society to have the appearance of doing something that has something to do with national security when they're just, structuring a slave state. I mean, if you look now at all of the these little technological apparatus. You know, the NSA is like looking at all of the emails, and I mean, the whole internet was just developed, you know, by DARPA. It's just a way to make sure that when we communicate, we're being observed, right? And make sure that it's in a computer form so that we can be instantly observed, right? I mean, this is really what the whole purpose of the thing is just to create this, you know, where you don't even want to try to communicate in any other way other than through the controlled computer system that the intelligence secret society operations are, you know, kind of overseeing. And, you know, and so then you can have Google or Facebook or Skype. Mm-hmm. But the fact is this is all easily, you know, plugged into the big computers that they've developed big data so they can analyze stuff. You know, so people say, well, Joe, gee, you're pretty depressing. Well, I mean, it's pretty honest.
Yeah.
But the fact is that believe me, humans are remarkably, you know, sort of multitasking capable, and we can resist this crap. First of all, we can resist propaganda just by being aware of it. And then secondly, we can start to bend democracy in a better direction by, first of all, speaking honestly among ourselves. You know, this is the thing that I am more and more advocating, is just trying to get people to be honest in their own conversations. Don't go to a social gathering and then not discuss your feelings about 911 or the CIA because you're intimidated. The intimidation is inside you, and that's what we can first rebel against. So when you go through the CIA, its construction, what it does, you go, oh my gosh, you know, it's this horrible thing. What can I do? It's all omnipotent. You know, I'm just crushed. Forget that. Just go out and be honest at the next social gathering. That's all I have to do. And then if we find that more and more people will break the intimidation because a courageous soul decides to speak up about how stupid 911 is as an Arab terrorist event, right? Then who knows, you know? You don't know where that'll end. And that's what, you know, when you get into stuff like the CIA, because I often get these comments from people where they say, well, you know, you seem to be right, but it's so depressing. Why? Why is this depressing? This should be exhilarating. Gain some courage and some energy for social rebellion, and you don't have to, you know, learn how to live in the woods like a squirrel in a prepper bomb shelter or something. Just learn to be honest at social gatherings. That's where the rebellion is right now. It's just in communication between ourselves. And so, okay, CIA, pretty nasty thing, pretty, it's definitely trying to set up a slave state. We can resist it just by understanding it.
It's also actually encouraging because it suggests that the world's problems isn't some broad-based flaw in humanity, where the world's full of killers and it's disordered and it's full of violence and anarchy, and we need, you know, these agencies, whether it's the military or intelligence agencies, to bring order through the use of selected force in certain areas. It suggests that the problems really can be assigned to the big problems can assign to a very small, relatively small group of people.
100%. That's really a great point.
Who are doing these things.
That point is much more important, more emotionally moving than the fear, you know, about, oh my gosh, they've got this brave new world snooping capacity. Think about what Tim just said. I mean, it is so profound. That is so right. Look, the reason the world is so screwed up is because you have the Masonic crypto effort to gain world domination going on. It's not a flaw in human nature that you're looking at. You're looking at a project. That's why the world wars exist. Look at how artificial, like, the Nazi party is.
Mm-hmm.
Just look at that. Look at all of the elements that go from the Nazi Party directly into the Quattro Coronati Freemason Lodge. Look at all the backing forth between the finances of, you know, the Brown Brothers Harriman, for God's sakes, you know, and Skull and Bones. This isn't human nature failing. preposterous. This is a project. The fact is, if we didn't have this project trying to destroy us and become, the new world order, you know, they want order meaning control and power. Believe me, we would already be at basically the kind of world that you'd really want to wake up in every single morning.
Yeah, or at the very least, it'd be a lot more peaceful, more prosperous.
We could,
a lot less suffering, yeah.
There wouldn't be suffering, because all of the problems we have, every problem we have, is directly relating to how they are shaping our world for control. And so that means that the misery we experience with the world wars and the plagues and the, you know, all the things that are brought about by their effort for world domination, if that wasn't existing, I'm telling you, the place would be very peaceful. It would, they say, well, gee, it would just be another group would come forward. I doubt that very much, and I'm willing to take my chances with that idea. I think the world would, if we could expose the secret society, I think that the very next, and then bring it under control and destroy it, the very next day, you wouldn't have chaos and you know, Sodom and Gomorrah. You would have the process started to actually have some, you know, expressions that like social equity come to mind, right? Because this stuff would be trivial to solve. The medical problems, the financial problems, health, all the we're sitting here suffering, right? With the crap food, because these are projects designed to make us suffer, to make us weak and stupid and sick, right? That's, mm-hmm. that's what's going on. It isn't just, oh my gosh, we need all, you know, like all of this, these chemicals in the food because it's the only way you can get to enough food to feed all these people. This is nonsense. It's ludicrous. It'd be trivial to change these things into a, you know, really, you know, into a structure whereby, you know, we could be healthy again. And so, you know, even like this idea about the population bomb and the baby boomer and overpopulation, even that's ludicrous, mm-hmm. you know, it's stupid. So we have to just recognize, look, the whole system from the CIA to the media they control to the banking system with the dollar, it's all just designed as a slave state. It's there to twiddle with our minds so we think that this chaotic world is, you know, just blowing up all around us and all we can do is look for the, you know, some kind of like government agent to come and save us. Well, you know, we've got to save ourselves, you know.
Now, a big understanding, I guess, is you have to look at CIA as organized crime. And yeah. As Doug Valentine's book says, CIA as organized crime. And one of the best ways to look at it that way is to analyze its history. You look at its history of the CIA and its facilitating and managing the global drug trade. Of course, this goes back way back, because even the CIA, of course, the CIA was formed out of OSS, and the nucleus of OSS was largely formed or influenced by Skull and Bones, a secret society out of Yale. And of course, the Skull and Bones group was funded by the Russell Trust. The Russell Company had made its fortune in the opium trade in China, partaking in the opium trade. So its ties back to the international drug trade are, its origins are the international drug trade, and its main job is managing it. This goes back even to the 1930s and the operations in China, Burma. In the run-up to the war, the Pacific, America's war in the Pacific, it was the fall of China, where the nationalist Chinese, the KMT, the Kuomintang, which was giving, which America, I think it was America's stated policy to support the nationalist Chinese, the KMT. Of course, you all know that there was some covert efforts and also in supporting Chairman Mao at the same time. So there, it was a dialectic being controlled by Western intelligence agencies to destabilize and direct China in a certain direction. But nevertheless, the KMT, after it was expelled from China mainland, and it maintained its residual force in Burma largely through the sale of opium, which was facilitated by the OSS. and later the CIA. The same thing happened in the 1940s. In an effort to control the Italian elections, and right after the Second World War, to supposedly prevent the communists from winning, they got into bed with Luciano, Lucky Luciano, who helped suppress the communists, and also it was funded. They gave in return for that effort, they gave him the franchise there, and this was so-called French Connection. So the CIA was facilitating the importation of heroin into the United States via Turkey through Marseille and into the United States. Of course, the Vietnam War itself, Air America, there was Vang Pao in Laos, who was this general who was being paid to field an army of teenage boys, funded. He was paid with opium. And, of course, Air America was a CIA subsidiary or front company that was an air force, more or less, that was built up to fly the opium out. And, of course, during the Vietnam War, it was the transportation of troops and materiel that was used as a conduit to ship heroin into the United States. You have, in the 1980s, before that, you have CIA's efforts in Afghanistan when the Afghan war was fomented by the United States, draw the Soviets in, and then the CIA's job was to go in and support a war against the Soviets, and that was largely funded through the heroin trade. In Central America, the dirty wars down there, Gary Webb did series of expose articles for the San Jose Mercury News, which exposed the CIA was indeed shipping in cocaine. What happened was they were to illegally send arms down to Central America. It was paid for with cocaine, which was then distributed throughout the United States. And Gary Webb's article, I guess, focused on the cocaine that was flowing into Los Angeles and became crack cocaine and helped fuel the crack cocaine epidemic in the United States. Just more recently, of course, you've had the explosion of of heroin out of Afghanistan, at least the poppy crop that was largely suppressed by the Taliban up until 2001, that the U.S. invaded and exploded, and now I think Afghanistan is now supplying 90% of the world's heroin. And you have multiple cases of CIA planes that had been known to be linked to CIA operations crashing with a ton of cocaine here. obviously the career of Barry Seal exposed the CIA's involvement in drug importation, flying into the country. And the thing is, we have something as big as the international narcotics trade, which is estimated to be maybe $1 trillion, 6% of the global economy. If you are the people, if you are the elite that set up outfits like the CIA and even the Pentagon, you want to control things. You're simply not going to have something that lucrative being a wild card. They're going to control it and manage it. And that's really what the true mission of the CIA and its subsidiary, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency. And the reason why the Drug Enforcement Agency was created in the 1970s was because the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, its predecessor, was investigating narcotics trafficking in the United States. And every time they got above street level, they ran into an intelligence operation, domestic intelligence operation, that's CIA. And so they couldn't have any of these investigations above the street level because it was an intelligence operation. And what happens is, whether it's the Sinaloa cartel, the Medellin cartel, from time to time, a drug cartel is going to be supported by the Central Intelligence Agency and other intelligence agencies for a while to kind of use them to ship in the drugs. And then they fall out of favor for one reason or another, and a new cartel is set up. Just recently, we had a case in federal court in Chicago where a member of the Sinaloa cartel is on trial, and he claimed he was working with the CIA. And his testimony was suppressed by the U.S. attorney under the Classified Information Act, which is invoked when evidence in court threatens to reveal an intelligence operation. You have all these examples, and now it's like everyone knows that CIA has been involved in drug trafficking. You still have people to this day denying that the fact that the CIA is the biggest drug importer in the world. People call it the cocaine importation agency. So it's out there. So, I mean, it's a criminal organization, and there's no law. There's no law that guides it, and there's no effective oversight. There's no law that really guides this agency. It really is, by nature, a rogue agency.
That's why it was created. That's why it was created like the structure that it has. It was created so that you can't bring our laws from the peon Congress people, whoever we're actually able to elect, into controlling the CIA. I mean, getting back to your the process of historically of like the drug trade. On our last show, you brought up, you read an excerpt, I believe, or just synopsized an author, a woman, I believe, who had...
Dr. Nancy Banks, yeah.
Yeah, and she brought up the point that, you know, we have the inner city drug selling boogeyman, right, as sort of a national icon and a plague, you know, on inner city culture. But she pointed out that, well, let's look at the drug trade and let's look at the financing and legal and sort of banking structure of it all. Is that something that an inner city kid could actually in any way ever even imagine? And this, of course, is ludicrous. So what you're really trying to deal with is the lowest and most unsophisticated part of the whole basically Masonic system, right? And this is the one who we see in the newspapers, you know, the inner city drug selling boogeyman. But the fact is, if you actually look at it in the way you were describing, you know, a few minutes ago, you can pretty easily trace the drug trade. When you talked about the Russell Trust, well, let's not forget that good old Hang Seng Banking Corporation, you know, HSBC, that was yes. Actually, I mean, here there really isn't any sort of camouflage, you know, just because of, you know, at the end of the Opium War, the opium traders needed to have a way of like managing all the money they were going to make. And so they set up a bank that would be both in Hong Kong and Shanghai. And it was just simply set up to handle the drug money. Yeah. And this is what it was, right? And this is when you talk about the Russell Trust, you're talking about money that is being basically moved around and overseen by this banking cartel. This is what the Russell Trust was you know, involved with. And so then when you go forward and then you see the Russell Trust setting up Skull and Bones, right? And then Skull and Bones now, you know, as it spreads out into international banking, you know, it comes right back into more control over drug money, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's never really, as far as I can see, this also goes back to the point I was making about what the world would be like if we could ever get the secret society extinguished. All of this horror that we've been experiencing with drugs, and I mean, opiate addiction now is become legally a horror story in America, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it isn't just the heroin and crack cocaine guy on the street corner. I mean, now it's the doctors that are just giving, you know, Oxycontin for every possible ailment, and there's God only knows what the actual number of people are in the United States that are addicted as we speak.
Yeah, I think the Sackler family, they increased the strength like 8 times to protect its patent, their patent.
Exactly. And they're simply building on the banking interests that smashed the Chinese in the Opium War. I mean, it's a very straight pipeline, and so...
And the opium war is a good model, too, because we're not just talking about people who are finding a market to make money, right, to sell a product. There is you can use drugs, you can flood a community, a city, a country, a part of a city, to destroy it, destabilize it, for perhaps to gentrify it 10, 15, 20 years later. They do it to countries, they do it to American neighborhoods. At the same time, you inflict high rates of crime on a community, family breakdown, these things, and you create, again, a lot of bodies that can fill the privatized prison industrial complex. So we're back to slavery again.
Right, but also you're shattering the culture so you can get in your political class.
Which is Brave New World, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, so that's the Masonic project is always the same. I mean, it's always shatter the culture, bring in politicians to handle a crisis that have... that lie about a cover narrative, who they are, their cryptos, their Masons. And then as soon as you get control, you just kill anyone that attempts to change the political structure from what you've got it. Once you're in power, you don't stop being in power. You just come up with new cover stories and, you know, a new dialectic. You know, you have, you know, Perestroika with Gorbachev as opposed to the Politburo and Brezhnev, but it's Soros is their book. With both sides, you know, of that dialectic. So
yeah, at the same time, you're facilitating the inflow of drugs. To say you're fomenting a war in some country in Southeast Asia that no one can locate on the map, and at the same time you're doing this in the 1950s, you're publishing stories in Life magazine that exist that are in everyone's doctor's office, dentist office, and so. Millions of people read this stuff, and you're promoting psychedelic drugs.
Yeah.
At the same time, you're experimenting with LSD. So, yeah, I mean, it's so you can change the culture. At the same time, you can change the objective conditions in an area and also demoralize the people with the degenerate drug culture and promoting sex and these things. So the culture, the people themselves don't have the character or the personal wherewithal to even resist, you know, the temptations or blandishments of these, you know, of what you're offering. Psychological warfare, right?
So. Absolutely. I mean, and then we're told to worship our slavery. They give us James Bond films, you know, where 007 on His Majesty's Secret Service, whatever it is. I mean, this is, you know, it's kind of ludicrous, but it's also very sad that this kind of propaganda, this kind of really stupid mind control, is even effective any longer. And, you know, hopefully. The alt media now has enough sort of centrifugal force that it can just keep growing, because there is enough details and facts out and clear analysis, not just from our show, but in hundreds and hundreds of places, that everybody can start to see what's happened, right? We can start to see that, you know, humans are not really completely nuts. We aren't born just to create, you know, firebomb Dresden. I mean, these things are artificial. Our whole history is a system of propaganda. So we can be free of it. And when we are, you know, the first step is we've got to get the secret society under control and extinguish. And then once we do that, we can, you'll see that I hate to be romantic, but I have a feeling things will be a hell of a lot better, Tim. Than what we've been facing. And so when we look at the CIA, you know, don't think of it as just a technologic snooping kind of slave state. You know, it's really there just to create a really miserable life for you, because that's one of the key things that the secret society does. They want misery. That is their goal for the human race. They want misery, because then we will be willing to accept, you know, the political power that they desire, because we are, you know, in danger of something basically they've created. So, you know, and creating misery. And so then we would turn to something like, the Hitler or Lenin or George Washington. You know?
Yeah. Man on the white horse.
Yeah.
I'd like to share this is with the audience. This is from Doug Valentine's book, CIA is Organized Crime, and he writes, "The war on terror is the greatest covert operation ever. In explaining why, I'll begin by defining some terms, because when discussing business, politics, and terrorism, word management is all important. The FBI defines terrorism as the unlawful use of force and violence against persons or property to intimidate or coerce a government, the civilian, a population, or any segment thereof in furtherance of a political or social objective. Clearly, this ambiguous definition begs the question, when is terrorism lawful? The U.S. government's stated policy regarding terrorism is well known. It always condemns terrorism accordingly. America is never a perpetrator of terrorism, but always a victim of it. The war on terror is the ultimate expression of this stated policy. It is lawful violence and self-defense, not unlawful violence by a non-state actor for a political or social purpose. This is the stated policy incessantly hammered into the dim American collective consciousness by the Pentagon and the State Department saturation ad campaigns. But if one looks behind the suffocating cloak of secrecy, censorship, and propaganda that surrounds the government's unstated policies, an entirely different story emerges about deliberative war crimes against humanity committed on a massive scale. Like Diogenes with his lantern held high, I visited the FBI office in Springfield, Massachusetts on 21 November 2012. I didn't have an appointment, but one of the resident agents agreed to listen to me. My intent was to make him respond to evidence of the CIA's engagement in and in support of terrorism in Syria. To that end, I cited a 21 June 2012 New York Times article stating that a small number of CIA officers are operating secretly in southern Turkey, helping allies decide which Syrian opposition fighters across the border will receive arms to fight the Syrian government, according to American officials and Arab intelligence officers. I asked the FBI agent if the article wasn't proof that that CIA officers were engaged in terrorism. Not only was CIA violence designed to overthrow the Syrian government, it was driving thousands of civilians into poverty, ruin, early graves, and despair of exile. And while the President and Congress undoubtedly gave the CIA legal authority to overthrow the Syrian government, its violence against innocent Syrian civilians was certainly illegal, yes? I added that, according to the Times, CIA officers arranged for tons of weapons to be smuggled across the Turkish border by way of a shadowy network of intermediaries that included jihadists the U.S. government itself identified as terrorists. Apart from managing a criminal conspiracy within the illegal arms and drug smuggling network, I said the CIA's arming of al-Qaeda constituted support of terrorism, even if the U.S. media kindly refers to CIA-sponsored terrorists in Syria as rebels. The flabbergasted FBI agent referred me to an FBI headquarters. And after a lot of artful dodging, the FBI spokeswoman, Kathleen Wright, threw in the towel and said, with regard to questions about CIA or U.S. government policy related to the CIA, that is not within our lane to answer. In other words, the nation's premier law enforcement entity has no legal authority over the CIA. Only within the context of this institutionalized double standard can a profitable business of American terrorism be properly understood. The CIA manages international arms trade like it manages the drug trade through a covert army of mercenaries from every nation, all of whom are homicidal maniacs with combat experience and a thirst for more of it. During the Vietnam War, the CIA paramilitary officers in charge of this army were called knuckle draggers. The mercenary army is supported by deep cover CIA finance officers operating offshore banks like Nugent Hand, deep cover logistics officers like Ed Wilson running proprietary and deniable shipping companies, and foreign intelligence state officers within the CIA's back channel counterterrorist network, corrupting strategically placed officers and special policemen often trained at American schools, as well as politicians who then provide a safe passage for the drug traffickers and black sites for torture as needed, all compartmentalized and managed by the big bosses at the CIA. CIA officers and their political bosses are never punished for engaging in terrorism. As we recently learned, they can get away with planting plastic explosives in a Virginia school bus. It was a training exercise, we were told. But why are CIA officers trained to plant explosives in the school buses? Because once you enter the CIA, the rest of us, even school kids, are either lab rats or cannon fodder, as far as the CIA is concerned. So...
Yeah, I mean, really important information. And you can see how the structure... is designed to basically, you know, you have the FBI, you have its relationship to the public. The FBI has some ability to look into, you know, governmental malfeasance. But as soon as you get inside this, the structure of the CIA, when you get deep enough, then you can't see anything. Then it's opaque.
Well,
then
wasn't Comey the FBI director, a board member of HSBC?
Yeah. So there it is. So I mean that's your first clue as to what, you know, if you actually got the door open and you could look inside, what you'd find. So, you know, we have a problem of democracy. We just have a lump of malfeasance that's hidden behind a particular door. You know, it's the whole secret society. But they have to keep that door shut, right? Now, we're opening the door analytically, right? This is what we're doing. We're saying, wait a second, all of these things indicate what's going on behind the door. We're building the schematic, as we call it, right? That's mm-hmm. inside that room where the secret society is planning the misery of the human race. We can approach the truth analytically. But what I'm hoping is that with, you know, a more powerful groundswell from the citizen, we can actually open the door physically and start getting real whistleblowing going on, so that the process by which the population can understand how to rebel from the secret society's control and how the use of all of things like the CIA will be expedited, right? I mean, the process is really moving along nicely, in my opinion. More and more people are seeing that there is a door that behind which is malfeasance. That, you know, there's 100,000 ways of understanding it, different theories and things like this. No one really knows what's behind the door. But the fact the door exists is getting to be common knowledge. And hopefully this will, people will stop, you know, in the same way we will stop paying attention to the fake currency. We will stop paying attention and giving allegiance to the fake political dialectic. The Democrats and the Republicans are completely controlled. You know, they're as much under the thumb of the oligarchs as the CIA is. So we need, you know, a different approach to our sort of political activity, a higher quality of democracy.
Yeah, it's funny you use the term democracy, and was it Samuel Huntington in the 1970s who declared a crisis in democracy? And what he meant by that wasn't that self-government and accountability of government and, you know, freedom of speech was being challenged. The crisis of democracy was that people were beginning to think too much and be critical of government, and that needed to be reversed. And this gets into psychological warfare, which is the chief operation of the CIA. This is why it's involved in movies and these things, and not just movies that promote the CIA, but also promote certain cultural outlooks, worldviews, and movies and these things. This is why they're involved in like promoting CIA and the Defense Department's involved in shows like Cupcake Wars, you know, or, you know, Cutthroat Kitchen and these shows that people watch on cable TV. The cop shows and shows that lionize CIA agents and these things as, you know, defenders of freedom and defenders of the country. But the idea was that you really have to, they really fear the idea of the public broadly knowing what's going on. That's what people have to understand, which is why Operation Mockingbird is so important, and why Mockingbird 2.0 or 3.0, which is going on, whichever is going on now, is very important, because they have to control the perception of things, of the world. And that's why you have CNN and Fox News and these things and out there. That's why all these, from the moment you had the networks from after the Second World War, they all grew out of the wartime psychological warfare offices, intelligence agencies, and they branched out, and this became, you know, the network news, and, you know, this, they all, you know, and all the newspapers were controlled by it, so it was going to control their perception. But most of all, it was not just that, but it's also music and entertainment and movies and, you know, these things, and it's full spectrum dominance, and there's nothing that they're not going to leave anything to chance.
They're already, you know, like, look at the quotes from Cass Sunstein about the threats to democracy that the social media represents.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's someone that needs to, you can really, you know, you should pay attention to, people should pay attention to his quotes and, you know, what he's promoting, because
cognitive infiltration.
I mean, he's really kind of one of their spokespersons against the power of the alt media. He's saying that, you know, he says, gee, you know, you got to be careful because democracy is so fragile. Democratic self-government is fragile. And it could turn into an authoritarian. Notice the use of the word, you know, mm-hmm. It could turn into an authoritarian way if, you know, these alt media, you know, zanies get rolling with conspiracy theories. We could end up with like a less democratic world. In other words, if the, you know, when the alt media starts to actually turn people into thinking beings, we're going to have to stamp down with some military force to keep them in prisons to stop them, you know, from trying to exercise the ability to fight for freedom. And so you know, you can already see that they're kind of, you know, obviously they're well aware of what's going on, and they're trying to manage population back into you know, safe areas, but they have no hope. There's just no way. There's just too much information that's out. Too many people are sharing information. I mean, it's going to be a chaotic period. I would just tell people that, you know, we aren't going to enter, in my opinion, into kind of a gentle slide to an extinguish of kind of human consciousness with, you know, Masonic control, just basically replacing hoi polloi with robots. I think it's going to be, I think you're yet to see freedom give a chance to strike back, and I think it is going to happen. And I think so. Just be prepared for bumpy times, and we should look forward to it, right? I mean, you know, we're not trying to help human misery increase. We just want to not be extinguished. We want to have no more genocidal projects that the fake dialectics maneuver us into slaughtering ourselves. So we have to, get control over these government apparatus. And, you know, that's just going to be a bumpy road.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, Joe, I think we covered it?
I think so, Tim. Okay. Looking for having now, you know, we're actually recording this before the 4th. I think Tim is going to put it out this coming Saturday after the 4th. So I wish you a happy 4th of July and Independence Day, and a post salutation to all of our listeners.
Yes. Joe, thank you.
And thank you.
Talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.